is KCPX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Father Ian's story about tariffs in the food and drinks industries on the Central Coast.
I think the thing that I would emphasize with the tariffs is just the chaos of trying to plan. I mean, that's the part of it that has been very disruptive.
Then, my conversation with poet M.T. Valyarka about the trauma of migration and poetry.
My parents have never really let go of the trauma of migration, and I write poems as a way to be in kinship with my lonely parents.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 30th, 2025. I'm Hair Ali. Let's start with Carol Tangerman's new segment, Talking Downtown, where she brings us stories from downtowns across the Central Coast. This one is sourced from KCSB, where reporter Lisa Osborne tells of an earthquake that hit Santa Barbara exactly 100 years ago and destroyed its downtown. This led to a decision to rebuild downtown Santa Barbara in the Spanish style. Have a listen.
My guest today is going to talk about that fateful morning when the earth started shaking at dawn on June 29th, 1925. Betsy J. Green is a local historian and author, as well as a member of the EQ25.org. That's the group that's leading up this Santa Barbara earthquake centennial and putting on an event called Quake Fest coming up on Saturday. Betsy Green, thanks for joining me.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Lisa.
So share a little bit about yourself with our listeners. You're a historian and author, and explain how you do your research.
A lot of my research does come from local newspapers. We were very fortunate that here in Santa Barbara, the local newspapers ran interesting stuff. A lot of small town papers, all you get is who got married, who died, and it looks like we're going to have a good crop of beans this year, or walnuts or something like that. But here in Santa Barbara, some of the local journalists had an interest in interesting happenings. They would write about somebody's pet monkey got loose, or somebody had a pet parrot. And certainly during the Flying A silent movie days, they were writing about all kinds of hijinks that the local actors were putting on.
You have written several books about Santa Barbara's history. You have a book on the Flying A. So what was life like in Santa Barbara in 1925? This was pre the Spanish colonial architecture. Maybe there was some. Were tourists coming to Santa Barbara at that time?
Yeah, tourism was a big draw here in Santa Barbara. We didn't have industry. We didn't have a lot of agriculture. So tourism was a big draw. And even before the earthquake, people like Pearl Chase and Bernard and Irene Hoffman were getting together and saying to the city, gee, we could have, you know, an architectural theme that respects our Spanish heritage. What about it, guys? And then, well, you know how people are always saying, there's never an earthquake around when you really need one. Well, we got the earthquake. The next day, Pearl Chase and the Hoffmans got together and said, hey, guys, this is our chance. Let's redo Santa Barbara in a historic style that will attract tourists.
So what did it look like? Was it kind of a hodgepodge of different designs down State Street at the time?
A historian says State Street looked more like Toledo, Ohio than Toledo, Spain. So when people move to a new location, they usually bring their ideas of architecture with them. So a lot of the people who built on State Street were from back east or the Midwest, and they built things that they were familiar with, and they really were not familiar with earthquakes either. So that was another thing going on.
There were some new buildings that were, well, they were new at the time. They're celebrating their 100-year anniversary this year, the Granada and the Lobero. So those withstood the earthquake.
Yes, we were very fortunate that we had some buildings that the urban reformers could point to and say, hey, look at these buildings. So as you mentioned, the Granada and the Lobero Theater had just been built in 24. The City Hall was also new. The El Paseo was new. Santa Barbara High School was also new. So there was a lot of things before the earthquake. And then with the earthquake hitting, it was time to do an architectural do-over.
And I think you wrote that most of the major damage and disaster was right along the State Street corridor. Is that right? Was the Arlington a hotel back then?
Well, the Arlington was a hotel. Part of the Arlington Hotel did collapse, and there were two fatalities there. They think now that the epicenter of the quake was out in the channel somewhere and then traveled along State Street. The ground under State Street is alluvial soil, which sort of means rocks that have been washed down over the years and are not as stable as some other areas. So there were some people out on the street at the time that the quake hit, about 6:45 in the morning, and they actually said they saw building after building after building fall down as the shockwave ran up State Street.
Oh, that's incredible. You mentioned 11 people were killed, but it could have been more had the quake struck midday when more people were downtown. And then you just mentioned two people who died were at the Arlington Hotel. Were the rest just in various places downtown?
Yes, most of them were downtown. Most of them seem to have been hit by the debris. A lot of buildings that were built of brick, the bricks fell apart and the facades fell off. So a lot of the people who were killed seem to have been out on the street or maybe sitting in their car when, you know, part of the building fell down on them. But we were very fortunate that, for example, it was early morning, so most people were in their homes and the homes were not badly damaged. School was done, so the kids were home with their families and not out in school. Had it happened, as you mentioned, middle of the day during the school year, oh my goodness, you know, some of the school buildings did collapse, and you would have had parents running to the schools to see if their kids were okay. It really would have been a whole lot worse. And in some ways, we were lucky. It was summertime. It was a little bit warm, but it was not cold and rainy, and, you know, in February, that would have been bad too.
So you mentioned that already that Pearl Chase and her colleagues were already envisioning a new future for Santa Barbara the day after the earthquake, but the community in other ways also came together to support each other, right?
Within a couple of hours of the earthquake, and as I mentioned, it was about 6:45 in the morning, there were Red Cross or Salvation Army out on De La Guerra Plaza serving hot coffee and sandwiches. And so a number of people who needed some breakfast, because a lot of stoves were not working, a lot of chimneys fell down. So a lot of people were able to go to De La Guerra Plaza, and there were also some in Alameda Park and also Veracruz Park on the east side who were handing out food. Then the mayor of Santa Barbara contacted the mayor of Los Angeles after the phones were working, and I'll get to that in a minute, and asked for milk and bread and cooked food, which was sent to us the next day, thousands of loaves of bread. So as I mentioned, the phones were down initially. So what happened was we didn't have fires, as you asked about, because of San Francisco. San Francisco had a big quake in 1906, and they had terrible fires. So we learned from that. So when our quake hit, immediately the guy in charge of the gas plant shut down the gas, the guy in charge of the electrical plant shut off the electricity, and the guy in charge of water shut off the water. So we didn't have fires or accidental electrocutions or flooding. So that was very good. However, a lot of phone lines came down and the electricity was out. So initially we had no way of contacting the outside world to ask for help. So a couple of guys who were amateur radio enthusiasts went down to a electronics store on State Street and garnered the parts and the battery, et cetera, and set up a table in the middle of State Street and sent out an SOS signal. And this was picked up by a ship that was out in the channel, which then transferred the message down to the Navy in San Diego. So within a couple of hours or even the next day, a group of Marines came to Santa Barbara and they camped at Peabody Stadium at the new high school. Actually didn't have a whole lot to do. We didn't really have a lot of crime or looting or mayhem or anything. People behaved fairly well. So after a couple of weeks, the Marines left. But you can see on YouTube and other places some pictures of Marines walking around, and they looked very official.
Two people were at the Arlington Hotel who died, you mentioned, and then the rest were in the downtown area when the buildings started to fall.
Right. Most of the fatalities were in the State Street area. There was one man who was killed at the Mission. He was a gardener, and I guess outside somewhere. So as you've probably seen from photos, The mission did have some damage in the towers, especially.
It looked like a lot of damage. And you were talking about photos of, you know, what life looked like in Santa Barbara, and as well as earthquake destruction. So the Santa Barbara Historical Museum, it has an exhibit up, and I think the Faulkner Gallery at the Downtown Public Library as well.
And you can also go on the internet. I mean, we're fortunate that there were a lot of people taking photos back in 1925 and also moving pictures. When the quake hit and the word got out, some cameramen in Los Angeles that morning got in their cars and raced up here and took a bunch of pictures as well as moving images. There were also planes that ran, that flew over the city taking pictures of the damage. So that we can still see those today. And in fact, after the earthquake here in Santa Barbara, and you know, for the next couple of weeks, there was a lot of cleaning up to do and people were still kind of stressed. So the city put together a number of activities to help people relax. And one of those activities was they set up an outdoor movie theater on Lower State Street somewhere and showed movies outdoors. You know, silent movies from the 1920s, vaudeville acts and things like that. But one of the movies that they showed was an aerial movie of the damage in downtown Santa Barbara. And there were also people in Los Angeles who had a little bit of money who could pay $100 for an aerial tour of the Santa Barbara earthquake mess.
Wow.
So they would pay $100 in Los Angeles, get in a plane, fly up here, circle around, look at the damage, and then fly back to Los Angeles.
Wow, talk about a unique tourist opportunity there. Oh gosh. So I think at EQ25.org, we can see some of that silent movie and damage and destruction from the earthquake. And there's also information about Earthquake Fest that's happening on Saturday. So do check that out. So talk a little bit more about the news coverage. So was this international news?
It definitely was international news. Now, some of it was greatly exaggerated. You know, Santa Barbara flattened, thousands killed, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the 21st century did not invent fake news. But yeah, I found newspapers around the world, some of them in Europe. Actually, one of the good stories that I found was a newspaper in New Zealand. There was a man from New Zealand who was here at the time of the quake. He was teaching music, and he wrote a story about his experience here for the newspaper back in New Zealand. So it's sort of, call it the shock that was heard around the world.
Yeah, because Santa Barbara was of interest because we did have the healing benefits of our hot springs or, you know, the natural beauty.
Some of the stories that I found were people who were just passing through Santa Barbara. There were some people driving from San Francisco to Los Angeles. They said they drove down State Street, and right after they turned off State Street, the earthquake happened. So they stopped the car for a while, and then they drove back to look at State Street, and they said the buildings that had been fine, you know, a minute or two before were suddenly a great big mess. One train had just passed through Santa Barbara before the quake, and they got a couple of miles south of here when the train got wiggled around and they had to stop the train. And they said they looked out of the window of the train and they could see houses rocking back and forth and trees shaking around and people running out of their houses. So it was felt in other places as well. Certainly the worst was in Santa Barbara and the worst damage was here.
I think you mentioned a news story where someone was swimming in the ocean and there was not a tsunami, but maybe someone indicated there was something going on with the water, the shoreline.
Yes, it was a very strange event. Now, as I mentioned, the epicenter was out in the channel somewhere, and there was some damage on some of the islands there. Some of the cliffs fell down. But there was a story in one paper where one guy said he was out having an early morning swim. He was in water waist deep, and suddenly the water receded, and he was standing on the sand. And then he saw some rocks falling down and realized what was going on. Now, a lot of people asked about a tsunami or a tidal wave. We didn't have one. But what did happen was Sheffield Dam on the east Upper East Side broke, and a lot of water went down the east side, and it went across Cabrillo Boulevard and into the ocean. So there was a bunch of water later on Cabrillo Boulevard. So a number of people at the time saw that water and thought, oh, there must have been a tidal wave. But it was actually water from the dam, and we did not have a tidal wave, fortunately. It's interesting to see what they experienced and also how quickly the city came together. As I said, the buildings fell apart, but the people came together. There were social services in De La Guerra Plaza. A number of people took the bricks from their broken chimneys, built a barbecue, and cooked food for themselves and their neighbors and friends. People came together and helped each other. It was amazing.
Let's talk a little bit more about the design shift for Santa Barbara.
Well, it goes back actually to about 1915 when the Panama Canal was opened. Because of that, people in California got very excited about more tourists coming to California, and probably wealthier tourists than the ones who were coming on the train. So there was a huge exposition in 1915 in San Diego and also San Francisco. And the one in San Diego was built in a style called Spanish Colonial Revival, which was a lot fancier than the previous style. The previous style really had been Mission Revival. Now, we do have some Mission Revival architecture in Santa Barbara, mostly the train station and also the houses along Crocker Row up on Garden Street there. That's a simpler style. It's also connected with Mexico and also the Catholic Church. And then when 1915, when the Spanish Colonial Revival was started in San Diego, people grabbed that and said, okay, let's go with that. It's a more upmarket, fancier style, and it's associated with Spain rather than Mexico. So that was kind of going on before the earthquake, and the earthquake happened, and they said, okay, everybody, let's go with it, and people just jumped on board.
And was George Washington Smith already designing in that style before? I associate him with the Spanish colonial architecture, and also Luda Riggs. I don't know if you want to say anything about Luda.
Right. George Washington, Luda Maria Riggs were also designing in that style or a similar style. He designed, and both of them designed, the News Press building on De La Guerra Plaza. That's sort of a Spanish style. And then both of them designed the Libero Theater. And so both of those were kind of used as examples of what Santa Barbara could look like after the earthquake. And one of the good things is along State Street, not all of the buildings fell down. Some of the biggest damage for the buildings that were still standing was the facade fell off. So it was very easy to put a new facade on the buildings to give Santa Barbara a cohesive look.
Betsy Green, thanks so much for talking with us. I'm Lisa Osborne, and leaving you with the song about Santa Barbara's great earthquake of 1925. This is Vernon Dahlhart.
And then one fatal morning, just before the break of day, when all the town lay sleeping, the hills began to sway. Then homes and buildings trembled and went crashing to the ground.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Up next is Playing with Food with Father Ian.
Tariffs. We've been hearing a lot about them lately, but why would the Playing with Food team, whose remit is to report on the foods of the Central Coast, be interested in tariffs? Well, first, let's hear from world-renowned economist and former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich.
Tariffs are effectively taxes on imported products, which we ultimately pay. Say there's a 60% tariff on Chinese imports. When Walmart imports Mr. Coffee machines from China, which is where they're made, who pays the tariff? Not China. Walmart pays the United States government. For example, if Walmart buys a coffee machine for $20, the 60% tariff means they'll pay an extra $12 in taxes, bringing their total cost to $32 per machine. And if Walmart is paying 60% more, do you think they will cut into their profit margin and absorb that cost? Of course not. They'll pass it on to you. Plus, American manufacturers import a lot of raw materials for products they make, so their prices would go up too. So when you're paying more for groceries, gas, and housing, know where your money is really going.
Well, that was helpful. Where is my money going when I buy locally grown vegetables, locally produced beer, wine, and cider? I wonder if the recent tariffs have had any impact on the locally grown and produced foodstuffs along the Central Coast. So I gathered five local producers who have been featured on Playing with Food in the past and asked them what this tariff stuff is about. We gathered at the Hub on a quiet afternoon, and you'll hear the sounds of a working brewery and pub in the background.
I'm Brian Talley, and I'm the owner of Talley Farms and Talley Vineyards.
George Peterson, Central Coast Brewing, The Hub.
Britton Traub, Marketing Manager at Slow Food Co-op.
I'm Maggie Probilski. My wife and I own Two Broad Cider Works.
Also contributing is Josephine Lockhead from Cook's Vanilla in Paso Robles, who sent us an email about the impact of tariffs on the vanilla industry.
We're here to talk about tariffs and how they impact the food and drink industries on the Central Coast. First of all, what is a tariff?
So a tariff is a tax on foreign goods that are brought into the country or leave the country.
Both ways, yeah.
But three of you, your products are domestic. You make them right here in San Luis Obispo.
Right. We make, the final product is finished here. So the brewing industry, everything's global. We get New Zealand hops, we get hops from Germany, we get grain from Canada, we get merchandise from China and Taiwan and Vietnam. It truly is a global community. Do I want the high desert hop? No, they don't make a high desert hop. You know, there's certain places you can grow hops, there's certain places you can grow grain.
Well, Talley Farms and Talley Vineyards, you grow your stuff here, and Maggie, I've picked apples with you out.
Yes, the orchard that we manage is out on Monty Road. So we also buy from a lot of other producers, but mostly we are local California apple. That's what we're using for our cider. But we do need to package that into something. Bottles, aluminum, shipping boxes. Just top of mind, those are the things that we are seeing an increase due to tariffs, and that means we have to raise the entire price of our product because we do need to count for that in the packaging of our product.
You grow your stuff here?
We do, and I would say the vast majority of our cost is associated with the raw product, but we do rely on bottles. They're starting to now manufacture bottles in the United States, and that was something that was happening even before the advent of the tariffs. There's no alternative source to imported corks. We also rely on French oak. Even though there is oak that's produced in the United States, it just doesn't work for our product. So no matter what, we have to rely on that.
You know, we do want to use domestic producers as much as we can for our packaging, but there's either not the manufacturing here, and in the case of bottles, they're still more expensive when they're produced in this country than they are with tariffs abroad. So we still have to increase the price of our product, regardless of if we're getting domestic bottles or foreign bottles.
Britton, you said you buy all of these products here, right? From the three producers sitting around this table at the co-op. You're buying locally, so how are the tariffs affecting the co-op?
Because we're owned by the community, we have a really interesting way to operate. Other grocery stores may push the pricing over to the customer. We really try to not price gouge our customers, so sometimes we'll eat the cost or we will change our margins. So if there's an increase on a shelf-stable item or a local item, we'll shift the pricing so we can keep local items and other goods at a reasonable cost and shift it to somewhere else in the store for something that people may not buy as often, so we keep our margins around the same. The distributors are eating a portion of that cost. Mexico and Canada were originally kept out of the tariffs. There's certain products like bananas, eggs, avocados, and other things, but we're really lucky to live on the Central Coast where we can get a lot of that locally. So we're not seeing as large of an increase as most people assumed we would.
Okay, what about the farm?
We do produce avocados, and interestingly, avocados were higher in the spring, and the market has declined a little bit. I think it's very dynamic where there's a lot of supply right now that's coming out of California that's depressing the price. But there was the thought that we would have extremely high prices on avocados, and we're not seeing that just yet. We export spinach to both Mexico and Canada. That's really been unaffected by the tariffs. Whereas with wine, Canada made a very specific decision that they would stop buying California wine.
And
it was,
beer. Both.
Yeah, very political, and I think bourbon too.
Alcohol.
Yeah.
Everything produced in the U.S. was literally banished.
And I think it was easier for them to execute that because those items are purchased through state store systems whereas you're dealing with individual distributors and brokers on the produce.
It was very, very surgical. I mean, it was, I would say, within a 4 or 5 day period.
Right.
We got the notice that they will no longer be accepting orders, and then here's the shipping order for the order that was already placed that's sitting in the warehouse that we're not going to take. So we actually got $4,500 of the beer back.
But you had to pay for it to come back.
I did not.
Oh, okay.
They paid for the shipping. Annually, we do probably $10,000 or $12,000 out of country. It's not a huge amount, but something we produce for. Packages are different. The SKUs are different. It's designed for export. It's not like you just pivot and go to a different package in a different language now.
We haven't exported wine to Canada in several years, but one of the implications of shutting off that market is that all the other people that were exporting to Canada now need another place to go with their products. So it's just exacerbating excess supply in the market, which is bad.
Yeah.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and the Playing With Food team is exploring the impact on the on-again, off-again tariffs on the food and drink industries on the Central Coast. The four around the table who produce everything locally just shared the basics of the impacts of the tariffs. Josephine over at Cook's Vanilla imports all of her primary product. Vanilla is not grown in the United States. She says, in April, for reasons that remain unclear, a 47% tariff was imposed on imports from Madagascar into the U.S. Placing tariffs on Madagascar imports was unexpected and baffling. Madagascar primarily exports agricultural products that cannot economically be grown in the United States, while importing very little in return, as the impoverished nation cannot afford most American goods. The trade balance is not something that tariffs can or will correct. We were impacted by a couple of shipments en route from Madagascar. We rerouted the shipments to England to avoid the tariff when it was announced, 5 days later, that the tariffs were reduced to the baseline 10%. It was frustrating and caused interruptions in day-to-day business operations, the way the tariffs were instated and then retracted with very short notice. Let's continue the conversation around the table.
With the exception of the farms, the vineyards, the brewery and the cidery are all small producers, so you probably didn't have a lot of your imported products in storage so you could use up the backlog before you had to pay more. Is that right?
That is, but I just ran out of all my shipping boxes and I definitely saw a very high increase in cardboard.
Cardboard has been across the board, and we don't use cardboard boxes for the cans, but we use the packing shipping tray, and it's gone up like 15 cents a piece. We go through 900 in a canny, you know, 97 to 100 bucks, you know, in the margin of pennies, that adds up fast.
I'm saving all my glass cartons. I'm finding other boxes from the co-op sometimes to give my club members their shipment. I can't buy the 6-bottle carriers anymore for the bottles because they're like $4 a piece.
We talked about food at the co-op, but what about supplies?
Cardboard, ink, the stickers, that's where the price is coming in. Yep. So anything labels. That's labels, yeah. So the pricing of labeling is going up.
Damn.
Coffee too. That was one of the main products where a couple of our vendors reached out to us and are like, okay, we'll have to do a little bit of an increase on the price because there's the tariff on it, but the majority of the cost is coming from the packaging, not the product itself. Yeah, if you need boxes, you can always come to the co-op to pick up extra boxes, give it a second life. Yeah, we get deliveries twice a week, and we have tons of extra cardboard.
That's a good thing about being local, is that you can say things like that. You can turn to another supplier and say, oh, we got extra cardboard boxes. That's great. Labeling, you're talking about labels on the shelves, whereas you're talking about labels on your bottles and cans and your bottles, right? So I'm assuming that people, the general public, haven't even given a thought to the increase in labeling. How much more can a little label cost?
I don't know, but the folks that I get my labels printed up in Paso, I'm going to call them and be like, so what are tariffs doing to y'all? And then I can tell you later.
Well, we just order labels. Most of our stuff is either digitally printed right on the can or sleeved on the can. So all of the printers that we use in pallets, minimums are 3,000 cans, 6,000 cans, multiples of 3,000, 3,112 actually. It used to be anywhere from 19 to 21 cents a can with a label. And now they have broken out the can package by itself and the labeling cost, because they source the labeling cost, whether it's the sleeve or the ink or the digitally printed part. So the inked digitally printed ones have gone up 12 cents a can. The ink has been substantial. So what was 21 cents a can 4 months ago is now 32 cents a can. a label by itself was, again, 16 cents to 21 cents, depending on how it was made. Now they're 31 to 35 cents a label. So I just ordered labels this morning, and they're 35 cents a piece. So that's 10 cents per package twice.
So I just want to make clear, that's all due to tariffs. It has nothing to do with inflation.
The inflation, we already had the inflation bump earlier last year, and then it kind of subsided, actually. Things kind of came down there October, November, and then they stabilized, I'd say, in January, sort of, and then it was like, boom. We ordered glass in February that should have been there first week of March, should have been there for our anniversary party, so I had a two-week window. Those are shipping tomorrow because they didn't want to gaff us. I mean, to their credit, this was six pallets of glass that would have cost us 145% more the day that it was going to ship. Now it's back down to 10%, so it's still up 10%, which we are absolutely taking. He's taking some of it, and that was a contracted, we made it for George stuff before even he was president, and now, you know, 6 months later, so we're 4 months behind on the glass, and it's going to cost us 20 cents a glass more.
Wow. Josephine at Cook's Vanilla also has packaging issues. She says, our packaging and ingredients cost have increased 10 to 50% in price due to tariffs. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian with a local winemaker, a beer maker, a cider maker, a vegetable farmer, and a grocery store marketeer, with a vanilla producer contributing via email, discussing the impact of the tariffs on the food and drinks industries on the Central Coast. Josephine at Cook's Vanilla also touched on the uncertainty amid all the erratic changes, saying, there are difficulties that arise when there is little notice of a new tariff policy and then operating with an unknown future tariff policy. We still do not know whether the tariffs will be reinstated, which makes it difficult to project purchases. The group around the table elaborated on that.
I think the thing that I would emphasize with the tariffs that George just started to touch on is just the chaos of trying to plan for anything.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the part of it that has been very disruptive. People just start canceling their orders. We work with wine distributors all over the United States that have big import businesses. Proactively, they started buying a whole bunch of wine, imported wines, to get ahead of this. So they used all their budget to buy imported wine. So they had no money left to buy my wine.
Stuff, right?
That basically means that their sales reps are focused on selling all this inventory that they have. So there's just been, I think, a lot of very unintended consequences, very, very unpredictable, very, very chaotic has been the general theme since all of this started.
Yeah, the unpredictability makes it so very hard to make a plan and to budget for your entire year. It's constantly changing.
We are currently, for the first time in 28 years, at least the last 15 years, we're out of Monterey Street Pale Ale.
I know. And I tried to get one yesterday.
Yeah. You and everybody else. I have an order pending online. The guy says, well, I didn't see it on the thing, so I thought I'd call you. And I says, no, we actually are out. And he goes, how come? I said, well, because in January, when I ordered my grain from Canada, they held it. And it's a fresh product. They do all of the bag conditioning, and they sit on it. So you get a bag, and then you use it. You don't store it. Weevils, bugs, mice. I mean, I can't store a warehouse full of grain. And so we made a conscious effort, because it was only going to be for a minute, to not make Monterey Street. Well, once you bump a tank, the tank's full. So you can't just squeeze a Monterey Street in there for a couple nights and then pull it out and make beer with it. It's 19 days of tank space. It's 22 days of ordering the stuff. It's 3 months of ordering the can. So what we stopped ordering in January now is hitting itself full on first week of June. So we got through graduation, thank God, but pretty quick, you know, we're going to be out of juice box again. We haven't made peanut butter in a while. So all of these beers that we've pretty much come used to having, we're behind. So then my distributor, just like he was saying, makes a different decision. They need Lucky Day, and now they get Topo Topo, or they get Firestone. They replace it. They're not going to stop selling IPA because George is out. They're just going to find a different IPA.
The internal competition is getting worse.
So somebody who has an imported French wine and right next to his Chardonnay, oops, we don't have Tally anymore, but we've got Jummy Chardonnay. Oh, well, this isn't bad. It's not as good as my old, but they still got their wine. They're fine. So the end result is this U-turning from us all the way through the consumer cycle. Why are these people having to make all these decisions? Why are they having to deal with the chaos at their end? as much as we are. And it's like planning and organization and inventory controls and stuff like that are just out the window. That's not how you run a business. When you're down here growing the apple and you're up here drinking the apple, 65 things can affect that.
Despite the chaos and costs, there may be a silver lining to all of this. Don't get me wrong, we all could do without the chaos and the climbing costs, but there's a tangible Central Coast element to all of this.
Playing with food is for the Central Coast, and we're a pretty tight-knit community. What do you want people to know?
I want them to be hopefully patient with us if we do have to raise our prices. This is unfortunately where we are right now. Bring back your boxes, please. They are very useful and they are very expensive. They are gold. Ride your bikes more so you can buy more cider.
And supporting us as a team, and we support Tally, we support you, you support us. I mean, there is this triangle that is so self-fulfilling, I guess, that we do watch out for each other, you know, and if a brewery needs something, if a winery needs something, if a cidery needs, there's always something extra we can help. There's all this intrinsic Central Coast, you know, bond or love or whatever you want to call it, that makes us just that one step better than the average corporate environment. And we deal with the locals, we deal with the big guys. We all have to pivot. We've been pivoting now consistently since COVID.
In these tariff times, definitely support local when you can. And if you can't get out to their businesses directly, do come to the co-op because we try to make strong partnerships with all of our local suppliers. And there's power in working with your local community. And also just do the research and learn more about it, because I think a lot of these costs are unpredictable, but also it's subtle. Like if you think about the ink or the packaging, like when you look at that, recognize that these people around the table sitting with me are hardworking people of your community who are taking that cost and having to create the product that you love. They don't want to raise the prices on you. They're not doing this to like price gouge you. They're suffering. Be kind to them, be patient, and there's power in like supporting your neighbor.
We're already strained by all the inflation that we've had, and all of the money that we may have had saved before the pandemic has been eaten by the pandemic and eaten by the new economy that has emerged out of that. So we're already strained. And then to add these extra costs on is a further strain and further adding to our stress. The more stress we have, the less spoons we have to deal with everything else.
Is there by any chance anything positive about the tariffs that are affecting the food and drink industries on the Central Coast that we can go out on?
My standpoint is finding the friends in the neighborhood, in the community of the Central Coast here, and recognizing that we're all in this together, and so we're going to support each other and we're going to do anything in our power to help each other out. I think that is really coming through. When the customers know this and we know this, then it makes us really stronger together.
And that's why we love living on the Central Coast. So when your next veg box is a bit higher, when your Central Coast Cider Trail weekend is more than you budgeted for, when your gold medal winning cookies suddenly cost their weight in gold, or when your favorite local beer is on hiatus, remember what Robert Reich told us at the beginning.
So when you're paying more for groceries, gas, and housing, know where your money is really going.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Up next is a new segment brought to you by yours truly. It's called The Lonely Goat Cafe, and it explores immigrant life from a mental health perspective, specifically looking at the idea of loneliness, how people experience it, and how they use art, music, films, and literature to move through it. I am so pleased to have with me today Emti Valyarta. They are a poet and assistant professor of ethnic studies at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. They are the author of the poetry collection, What You Refuse to Remember. I love that title. Which was the winner of the 2022 Small Harbor Publishing Laureate Prize. MT has received fellowships from Lambda Literary, Kundiman, Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing, Abode Press, and Roots Wounds Words. Welcome, MT.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm curious to know, like, when I spoke to you about this podcast and, like, now what I was talking about, folks from immigrant and marginalized communities and all of that, did anything resonate with you, or is there anything that you want to share how you felt when I spoke about this segment?
When I heard the description of this segment, I was just like, yes, we need to have these conversations about migration and the loneliness that comes from it. I'm actually not sure what my generation is, because, like, technically I'm second generation because I was born in the United States. But then some of my friends say that I'm actually 1.5, because even though I was born in the States, I was raised in the Philippines from age 2 to 4. And those years in the Philippines were very foundational to my development as a young child. And I only spoke Tagalog at home. When my family returned to the States, I didn't speak English. I had to take ESL classes, and I remember that moment of, you know, not understanding what was happening in the classroom and being, you know, singled out as, like, the only kid in kindergarten who didn't know how to speak English, who had to go to the English as a second learner classes. That was a very, very lonely feeling. And this was suburban New Jersey before my family moved to Los Angeles, California.
Wow. Yeah, as you were speaking, I immediately went to my own experience of learning to speak English, which was so oppressive. I feel kind of connected with what you were saying, because even for me, in terms of just migration in general, like, I've moved around so much. The first time out of India was when my family moved to Nigeria and I was admitted into an American school. That was the first time that I had to speak English, which was at the age of 13. Mm-hmm. Because before that, in India, like, you know, it is an English medium, quote-unquote, school, but we speak in Hindi, you know? And so, like, it was so terrifying to articulate myself in English, and I got bullied for my accent. And so I changed my accent. And that's a really funny story, maybe. I don't know if I want to share it on public radio, but, you know, like, this experience of loneliness, for me, it's also connected to bullying. Mm-hmm. Like, prior to that, I had friends, and I had never felt, like, this kind of inferiority, kind of, at not being able to speak a language. And that was the first experience that I had when I went into that school. And, you know, I was just like, oh, I don't speak English, so I'm, like, lesser than these students. I was made to feel that. So, yeah. So, interesting, because now you write primarily in English?
Yeah, now I write poetry in English. I do write in Tagalog sometimes, but very rarely. And I think what poetry affords me to do is to experiment and play and even, like, mutilate the English language.
I love that
in my own way. Because in poetry, like, yes, certainly there's more traditional forms like sonnets, pantones, villanelles, where you have to follow a certain type of form or meter or rhyming scheme. But as a poet, you're allowed to experiment with those forms and break away from tradition. So in many ways, like, being a poet is also learning how to craft language for your own sake, to figure out how you can use, you know, this hegemonic dominant language to communicate what's so difficult for migrants, for people of color to communicate in the first place. So poetry allows me to share what I can't easily share in plain English or even in Tagalog.
Do you want to share one of your poems with us?
Yeah, thank you. So this poem is from my poetry collection, What You Refuse to Remember. It's called When You Don't Get Enough REM Sleep. I have dreams of turning into a broom, sweeping away the debris we call family. My mother said I should have been born the eldest, but instead I am wedged between a shovel and a machete. My grandfather was a ticket dispatcher at a bus station. He inhaled smoke until his lungs collapsed. My grandmother bore 11 children. One died and she sighed from relief. After several years, I have finally stopped biting my nails, but now I am obsessed with slowing out the dirt beneath them. My dentist said I should use an extra soft toothbrush. I stopped taking edibles and now take 2 buspirone with my tea. My older sister pitches natural remedies, and somewhere in my chamomile sleep, I chortle. I pitch a tent under lucky paper stars. I sleep with a jar of dust, cradling a $5 bill and fly swatter.
Wow.
Thank you.
It's so visual. And so many different aspects of your life and your relationships coming together to form this beautiful poem. Do you often, like, explore relationships and family, especially in your poems? What is the pull when you write a poem? Like, what are the things that you like to explore?
I definitely explore family and relationships a lot. So, you know, even though I speak my parents' native language, there's still an incredible, like, generational divide and cultural divide between us. And sometimes I feel like I write poems to so I can tell my parents the things that I would never really tell them in, like, a normal conversation. Like, yeah, we do talk about, you know, my grandparents in the Philippines who have passed. And I can tell that, you know, my parents have never really healed or let go of the trauma of migration. And I feel like my mom and dad are just inherently lonely because of that. But they don't want to talk to me about it. So I write poems as a way to kind of imagine what does it mean to be in, you know, to also be a lonely individual and to be in kinship with both of my lonely parents together? Like, how do I make sense of that kinship? And is there a way that we can still feel close, or I can kind of lay out our kinship, like our bonds, in a more concrete way outside of just talking to them or saying I love you, which, you know, isn't really a thing in a lot of immigrant families.
Yeah,
so for me, that care and that commitment to, like, kinship with my parents comes out in poetry.
When you said, like, trauma of migration, that was really interesting to me that you used the word trauma. My experience coming here has been that things are going well, and then I just feel this deep sense of nostalgia and displacement, and I don't know where it comes from, but it just hits me and I'm not able to make sense of it. Then my brain starts working in, like, the pros and cons. Is your life better here than there? Then what's the problem? You know what I mean? But the heart, it's like, feels it, like it's a push. So I don't know if you're comfortable, but do you want to share a little bit more about this experience of your parents or your family's, like, trauma of migration, the way that you articulated it?
Yeah, I think, you know, for my parents, because there's this sense that, like, oh, once you migrate, all your problems are going to be solved. You're going to have a better life for yourself and your kids. And, you know, that's the narrative that the U.S. feeds migrants, the American dream. But for my parents, you know, we've had this conversation before, and my parents agree that for them, like, the typical American dream of upward mobility, of eventually obtaining, like, a middle class salary, buying a house, like, none of those immigrant aspirations ever came true for them. You know, my parents still live in the same 2-bedroom apartment that I grew up in. My dad is retired now, but he still works part-time as, like, a restaurant worker. My mom has been a house mom, you know, housewife, ever since she came to the United States. And, yeah, they always say that in many ways, maybe life would have been better in the Philippines, but they decided to take this risk because when my parents were coming of age in the Philippines at the time, President Ferdinand Marcos was a dictator, and he had passed martial law, and there was a lot of corruption and graft and day-to-day violence that Filipino citizens were facing. So that was kind of like the push for my parents to come to the U.S. and seek like a better life for their children. Seeing how, you know, the landscape of U.S. politics is, you know, not as great as people make it out to be. Just looking at who our current president is right now and seeing all the rights being stripped from migrants and queer folks and Palestinians, my parents are just like, yeah, you know, we took a risk. And yeah, in some ways, things are better here. But in other ways, it might have also been better if we stayed because our family is there. And I'm pretty sure we would have found a way to make things do. But, you know, we can't go back. We can't reverse the decision. And my parents also recognize that it's been a privilege to raise my sisters and I here in the U.S. because we were exposed and had access to opportunities that we wouldn't have had otherwise in the Philippines. Like most youth in the Philippines, once they graduate from college, they either have to go through this very long job hunt so they can stay at home, or most likely they will have to work abroad and be an OFW, an overseas Filipino worker. And my parents didn't want that lack of options for my sisters and me. Like, they wanted us to be able to have as much autonomy as possible in deciding what we wanted to do in the future. So that in itself was a privilege that I was able to access as an American citizen, as someone who was raised in the U.S. But at the same time, I can't ever let go of, like, this nostalgia that I have for the homeland, especially since I grew up there as a child. And it was a treat to see my aunts and uncles and my cousins every single day, to always have someone to play with, to talk to have people who looked like you, who spoke your language around you. That was really nice, and I miss that still.
If you're just joining us, I'm Meher Ali, speaking with M.D. Baliarta, poet and Cal Poly professor, for my new segment, The Lonely Goat Cafe. So I wanted to actually read a poem by Linton Kwesi Johnson, who I believe is a British-Jamaican poet. The reason why I thought of it was because you were speaking about language, and then, what was the word you used? Twisting it or
mutilating it?
Mutilating it. I'm just going to read the first three stanzas of it. When me just come to London town, me used to work pan the underground. But working pan the underground, you don't get to know your way around. England is a bitch, there's no escaping it. England is a bitch, there's no running away from it. Me get a licking jab in the hotel, and after a while, me was doing quite well. Them start me off as a dishwasher, but when me take a stack, me not take clack watcher. England is a bitch, there's no escaping it. England is a bitch, no bother try to hide from it. So that was the best that I could do.
That was really good.
Thank you. Immigrants and descendants of immigrants in this country, and I'm particularly speaking about folks from marginalized communities here in the United States, we always have this kind of feeling of, like, what if? Mm-hmm. Because, as you said, like, the quote-unquote American dream is not for everyone. So, like, there is always this possibility of another life, like, almost like a parallel universe. Mm-hmm. And you imagine yourself living there as well as here. At the same time, like, there is a sense of community that we have, or maybe we long for.
Mm-hmm.
What does the word community mean for you, and how have you experienced it in this country? And then also, like, you know, you talk about Philippines. How have you experienced community in that country?
I think I was able to find kinship with other Filipinos when I came to college. Because in LA, I grew up in a predominantly Latinx neighborhood. So growing up, most of my friends were Mexican or Guatemalan or Salvadorian. And I actually didn't realize that Filipinos were Asian until, like, in elementary school, when my teacher told me, like, you know, the Philippines is in Asia, like, you're not Latina, you're Asian. And I was just like, but there's so many, like, cultural commonalities between, like, Latinx folks and Filipinx folks. Yeah, like I just felt this sense of kinship with my Latinx peers because most of us, or if not all of us, were raised Catholic. We all had pretty strong family values and family ties. Many of us would also go home to like our homelands too every once in a while, and we would talk about what it was like to go on those trips. So that's kind of how I was able to find kinship with other descendants of immigrants. And in college, that was the very first time where I was able to be around other Filipinx people that were my age. And even though I felt seen because there were people who looked like me and understood more specific like cultural references, it was still pretty lonely because a lot of the Filipinos at UC Berkeley, where I attended, came from more affluent backgrounds. They were more middle class. Parents had houses. A lot of them also were English speaking, like monolingual. They didn't speak Tagalog. There was still that sense of loneliness for me where like, oh, even though I'm around Filipinos, there aren't really a lot of Filipino folks here who have the same background or the same experience as me. And yeah, it was really hard to relate to some of my Filipino peers because many of them hadn't even been to the Philippines either, or just weren't as fluent in Filipino culture as I was. Yeah, there was still that sense of like, I wasn't on my own like island.
Yeah, I'm curious to know, how do you experience loneliness?
In my body, I tend to feel it in my stomach and in my chest. Like there's this sinking feeling in my core, and I describe it as like, oh, I want to like curl up into a ball and just sink. That's how I experience loneliness somatically. And I think I associate loneliness with nostalgia too, just like a lot of immigrants do, this sense of what if. And I think there's also this sense of not just what if, but if only. Like if only we stayed, if only. Like in college, I used to think like, oh, if only I, you know, had more money, or maybe I would have more friends and I would be able to relate to my peers more. To me, loneliness is this wish for something that you don't have.
I basically asked you to bring a poem that resonated with you, that maybe helps you to feel a sense of community or connection.
Yeah, so the poem I brought is by Hala Alian. She is a Palestinian American poet, and I'm just in love with her work. And this poem is titled I'm Not Speaking First, which was published in The Rumpus. Please, I wore the mascara for myself to remind my eyes they're green. December, old friends for an afternoon, and still I remembered you like Beirut. Unmade beds, Marlboros, a thing that never wanted me. Nowadays, I can nest my husband's grief inside me like a Russian doll. The smallest one is a black oval seed. Maybe I was wrong. You wanted me thin, so I ate. You wanted me sober, so I drank. I've always liked my lies. When something pressed against me, I took it fast. I don't have to tell you twice. Listen. I know I've made a mess of everything. I know it's too late. I've stood on your balcony, 25 floors above the cars and billboards and dunes, my eyes suddenly filling, but instead of speaking, God, that chain link against my back, you cradling the billiard ball you taught me to hit, I spat a full mile to the ground. You know me. I'll spin my bruised hip bone into an affair. I'll play with your new daughter until the sun sets. Back in Manhattan, when I do dream, it's of octopi, tentacles twisting their purple suckers around my finger like an engagement ring. Nothing's Freudian anymore. A cigar's a cigar. I want to love something. I want to love something without having to apologize for it. Please don't tell.
Thank you so much, Empty, for joining us today for Lonely Goat Cafe.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to have been here.
That was Emti Valyarta, poet and assistant professor of ethnic studies at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. We were speaking about loneliness and immigration at the Lonely Goat Cafe. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you've heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.